Welcome to the GoTo Podcast. In this episode, Eric Johnson interviews Ulf Wieger and Sasha Jurich on the BEAM languages Elixir and Erlang. They explore the relationship between the two languages, when they should be used, and focus on specific use cases for each. GoTo gathers the brightest minds in the software community to help developers tackle projects today, plan for tomorrow, and create for a better future. Stay up to date with the latest in tech through GoTo's top-rated events held online and in person in cities like Chicago, Amsterdam, London, and Copenhagen, and by subscribing to the GoTo Conferences YouTube channel, where you can find thousands more high-quality dev talks. Learn more at gotopia.tech.
All right, thanks for joining us here. This is GoTo Conference in Copenhagen. My name is Eric Johnson. I am actually part of AWS. I'm the developer advocate for AWS, but today I'm acting as an interviewer. So we're going to have some fun with that. And I want to introduce you to my two guests. I'd like you to introduce who you are and where you're from and what you do.
Okay.
Start with you, Sasha.
I'm going to start. Okay, so my name is Sasha Jurich. I come from Croatia, and I work as an independent Elixir mentor, helping teams adopt Elixir and work with it in production.
All righty. And Ulf?
Yeah, my name is Ulf Wieger. I'm from Sweden. I'm an independent contractor, mostly Erlang. I've been programming Erlang since forever, since 92, 93, full-time since 95.
It's been around, hasn't it? It was like the first language ever.
Yeah,
just
it was.
Before Latin.
Exactly.
Yeah, from Erlang's pretty old, isn't it?
It pretty much started life in 87.
Okay.
I would say 92 was the first time it became visible to anyone outside Ericsson, more or less.
Okay.
So I just happened upon it then. I was taking a course at the Royal Institute of Technology in Stockholm. Robert Wirding and Bjarne Decker were there giving a course about computers and telecommunications. And then they introduced Erlang. And so we got to do a little programming exercise where they had us write the sort of the control program for a telephony switch and then actually have it work first in a simulator and then on a real phone switch. And that was like a weekend exercise. And I was in complete awe.
You were hooked.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've been hooked since.
And so you're one of the first users of Erlang, basically, when you think about it, right?
It sounds like it.
I think I was actually the very first commercial customer because I ended up paying $1,000 for a license in 93. I don't know if that makes me the stupidest Erlang programmer ever, but
I have a couple languages and I'm willing to sell you as well.
There was actually a plan. We were forming a company in Anchorage, Alaska. And of course, being from Sweden, I had slightly strained relationship with INS.
Okay.
Or they were perhaps not so much aware of me, but we had to figure out a way for me to actually legally work in the US. So we actually decided to make a real strategic bet on Erlang. It actually made technical sense, mostly, I think, or I thought so.
Okay, that's all that matters.
So we actually bought a license and we started pestering Ericsson to say, okay, what is your story on support and everything? We want to bet on Erlang now, do you? And they were just starting up this company to sell Erlang, so I was their very first customer.
That's crazy.
And so it did, the one value, immediate value, was we had to advertise for Erlang programmers in Anchorage.
Right.
And we found exactly one. predictably.
it's a one-to-one language.
I was expecting zero, more like zero. Yeah.
So I got my H-1B visa out of it. So
well, there you go. That's a win-win.
Yeah.
Wow.
I was pretty happy.
Now, Sasha, you do Erlang as well.
I do now these days mostly Elixir, but I started with Erlang like almost 10 years ago. Yeah.
All right.
So they're kind of like, I mean, I don't know how much familiar you are. They are basically like different languages running on the same runtime or the same virtual machine. Erlang, of course, being the very first language running on the Erlang virtual machine, unsurprisingly.
Okay.
And Elixir came to happen like quite a lot later. The first version was released in 2014, but José Valim, the creator, started working on it in 2011. Yeah.
So would you call Elixir maybe an advanced version or a next generation of Erlang?
It's a really interesting question, yeah. I think that at some point, I remember hearing Joe Armstrong, the inventor of Erlang, saying that it's like the child of Erlang, so to speak.
Okay.
Yeah, it's definitely an evolution in some sense. It's definitely like the next generation, so to speak, taking all the good stuff, and a lot of the best stuff in Elixir is based on Erlang. You know, it comes from Erlang, not Elixir itself. Many will tell you that like the best thing about Elixir is Erlang, you know,
okay.
Not Elixir.
Okay.
It's like, you know, an icing on the cake, so to speak. Yeah.
Okay.
But Erlang has been designed like in early 90s, and I believe, you have been around much longer, I believe it's pretty much stable, you know, for the longest amount of time. Things have progressed in some sense, mostly in terms of ergonomics that we as developers want. And my impression, you know, as someone looking from the sides, is that José Valim, applied some of these new ideas and techniques from different kind of languages, you know, using both Erlang as inspiration, but also Clojure and Ruby and even some stuff from the .NET world to, you know, improve the UX of a language. But still in its core, it's like Erlang. I heard someone saying that it's almost like Erlang plus, you know. Yeah.
That's complex right there, yeah.
Yeah.
So let me ask you this. I sit down, I'm given Erlang, I'm given Elixir. Why do I pick one over the other?
Well, I would say that it depends. It depends a little bit on what you're trying to do, because I think one thing that Elixir brought to the Erlang community was that, well, for example, web developers, because it attracted a lot of people who loved Ruby, but were not so much in love with the scalability story of Ruby on Rails.
Right.
So suddenly they find this platform where scalability is just amazing, where you can really build conversational web services. Mm-hmm. Now, the Erlang community is very much into carrier class, fault tolerance, building really robust servers,
right.
Messaging,
durability.
But if you're kind of a UX guy, for example, Erlang is kind of a unimaginative community.
Yeah.
I mean, people don't really care about UX. I mean,
right.
We had, you're old enough to remember the
probably
old
barely, whatever you're gonna say.
these stupid BIOSes for the PC.
Yes.
You know, the keyboard missing, press one, F1 to
BIOS.
Continue.
Yeah.
We actually, when at Ericsson, when we got our first built or custom made Sun blades for our systems, they had that BIOS bug. So we booted them up and they said, keyboard missing, press F1 to continue. They were never meant to have a keyboard. So we had to send them back and get the BIOS fixed. Erlang systems were never designed to have much of an interface.
Okay.
They were embedded systems, messaging systems, and you would have some, you know, developer ugly HTML just for configuration management, essentially.
Yeah.
And so it was always very difficult to get any kind of UX story going in the Erlang community because people didn't really care. I mean, you couldn't get momentum. They thought, somebody else gets to flesh that out and put all the, do all the heavy lifting to make it really usable. But if you can make it really usable, I'll probably use it when I need a GUI, which is not very often. So I see that scenario where Elixir is much, much stronger because people actually go there too.
Sasha, what do you think?
Yeah, I think, as a quick background, I did like a few years of Erlang, a few years of pure Elixir, and somewhere in between both of them. And I would basically, you know, my impression is that Elixir is both a language which is more expressive and more complex, you know. And Erlang is like more simpler and more direct to the point, you know, very, very explicit language. Right. And it really, you know, raises like a lot of question about where on the slide from, you know, simplicity to complexity you want your language to be. And so Elixir gears more towards being more complex language. And Erlang is like, I think that the grammar of Erlang is very simple. It's a very regular language, no special cases, no ambiguities. A couple of those, for example, exist in Elixir. And so like Erlang is really straightforward. You know, people get intimidated because it looks like Prolog. But, you know, when you get past that, you know, initial impression, it's like very, very simple language, you know. But for me as a user, I had problems dealing with like boilerplate and repetition and stuff like that, because the language itself doesn't really give us too many tools there. And Elixir, you know, introduced some of the features in the language which made things much easier than they would be in Erlang. So that's basically my personal impression. And I believe that, you know, people who are, because we are not all equal, right? So there are people who prefer explicit over, you know, maybe more expressiveness, and the other kind of people who, like me, who maybe prefer to be a bit more expressive.
Right.
And, you know, it depends on your preferences. But as I said earlier today in my talk, really what comes from the runtime, you know, this concurrency model that Erlang gives us and every other language on top of Beam uses it, this is really where the key benefits are, you know.
Got it. Makes sense. So my only experience with Erlang is many years ago in a previous job, we were doing RabbitMQ.
Okay.
And you had to have Erlang installed for the, and from my understanding, I didn't know, it was almost the networking piece of RabbitMQ. It's what allowed the connectivity.
Yeah.
So that was really interesting. So I learned enough to install it and make the settings and call it good. Mm. So let me ask you this. You guys are both, we're here at Copenhagen, and we're at GoTo. Sasha, we'll start with you this time. What are you going to be speaking on, or what have you been speaking on?
I held a talk which was literally about the runtime layer of Erlang, the Beam, Erlang virtual, the official implementation of the Erlang virtual machine. And it was like a demo-driven talk trying to showcase, you know, why would you want to consider using these languages such as Erlang, Elixir, and there are like 15 languages or so built on top of Beam for, you know, building your software systems. And when I say software system, I mean like any backend, any web server of any kind of domain. And I believe that Beam is really designed very, very nicely for that particular type of problem.
Okay. Yeah.
And that's what I try to explain in the talk, you know, as much as you can in 45 minutes.
Nice. So were you live demoing?
There were a lot of demos, trying to make things more tangible and, more like relatable.
That's always fun, is live demoing. Mm. So you pray the internet's going to work. All that kind of stuff. So
yeah.
Very cool.
The trick is not to base your demo on the network as you can.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. Well, I, as an AWS serverless guy, I really have no choice. you hope the internet's working. So, what about you?
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Should I be excited or afraid of AI? The answer is yes, it's both.
Things are going to look so different in the next couple years. You will not be ready for the disruptions that are going to come. I'm Jeff Nielsen, host of Digital Disruption, the go-to podcast for technology leaders. Our generation's conflict, I think, is going to be emotional, not economic.
The companies that are going to win are the ones that have a couple of characteristics.
Stay ahead of the curve with Digital Disruption, available now on your favorite podcast platform.
Yeah, my talk is going to be about using Erlang in blockchain development, because that's what I'm currently into. I'm on the core team of the Eternity blockchain, which is a little bit special, maybe not the best known blockchain, that would be Bitcoin, but it is, as most people know, there are a lot of different cryptocurrencies out there. But most of them are essentially spin-offs of either Bitcoin or Ethereum.
Okay.
So the Eternity blockchain is actually a project to build a new blockchain from scratch, trying to incorporate most of the things we've learned in the last couple of years of blockchain research and making a lot of the interesting sort of add-ons that are sort of tacked on top of, for example, Ethereum as first-class objects on the chain, and see where that takes us. And that is actually implemented in Erlang. And it wasn't my choice.
Okay, I was going to say, what was the driver on that?
Yeah, so...
I think there are a couple of different blockchain implementations done in Erlang and Elixir. It's like a frequent choice.
So,
why? Yeah, I'm curious to see why.
So I...
Why not Node?
My...
I'm just kidding.
My personal feeling about why a certain language is chosen to begin with, it's usually... comes down to what your experts at the time felt that they either wanted to always program in or what they wanted to experiment in on next. So, and then if it works well, you come up with a story to justify why you picked the language and why it was the perfect pick. And, but usually that's just, I mean, essentially we all have our favorite languages that we try to, squeeze any problem into more or less. And that sounds more stupid than it is, because
it's life, though. I mean, yeah, I agree with you.
So in this, in earlier incarnations of this talk, I used to start out by basically asking, just what's the best language for poetry? And I think, well, that's a good measure of whether you actually can master a language if you can write poetry in it.
That's the best language for web editing, the best language for poetry.
Yeah,
so that would be Texan.
Absolutely.
How do y'all? Yeah, exactly.
I actually killed those slides because they're already on the internet. The answer this time would have been Danish, of course, but
I failed to agree with that. So I do like the Danish language.
There is some amazing Danish poetry.
Is there like any poetry written in Texan?
There is.
Really?
Yeah. How do y'all? How you doing? Got things a brewing. Right
anyway,
off the top.
I mean
folks.
Yeah. Wow.
That's double. Eric earned his money today.
Yeah. But, so. I mean, basically trying to just drive the point that the best language to write poetry in is probably the language that is native to you.
That's right.
Because it's a way of expressing very complex thoughts beyond the language, essentially. Yeah. And that's where we want to go as programmers as well. So we want to achieve mastery in at least some languages. And then those will probably be the languages that we are best at expressing very complex ideas in.
Yeah.
Unless whatever you want to do next falls out of the sort of domain of languages that you can very easily solve.
Yeah.
Right.
Like it's SQL, for example, right? You probably can write blockchain in SQL.
Yeah.
You know, people have been doing everything in everything, but yeah, probably really not like a good fit.
And then of course, the really unlucky ones, or lucky, depending on how you look at it, are the C++ programmers, because obviously you can write anything in C++, right?
Yeah, but you don't feel compelled to move beyond it, yeah.
Erlang is a little bit more opinionated in that there are certain things that you clearly cannot write in Erlang. And if in an opinionated language, it should be fairly clear what it's good at and what it doesn't want to do.
Yeah.
And if you go into a domain where you're using a language like Erlang or whatever that is very specific about what it wants to be good at, it's going to fight you every step of the way.
Yeah.
A lot of people who come into Erlang, for example, who are Java programmers or have only done object-oriented programming,
right.
They will spend like half a year.
That was me.
But hopefully less.
Objectify Erlang.
Yeah. Literally.
I did that too.
it's that it really is. It's a square peg round hole type thing.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. So finally, you get over it, and you decide that,
or you move on.
Mm, yeah.
It's not only is it not necessary, it is not going to work out well.
So I got a question for you guys. Do you think you could run Erlang serverlessly?
Serverlessly?
Yeah.
Well, if it's on someone else's server, you know.
Yeah, okay, all righty.
I,
on a Lambda, like an AWS Lambda, what do you think?
I think that it's going to be it's not going to be a good fit.
Yeah.
Okay.
Actually, when I was at Erlang Solutions some years ago, I was their CTO for a while. We had a lot of talks about whether you could build a cloud environment to execute Erlang code. And I think we pretty much shelved the idea and decided that, no, Erlang is really good for building cloud environments, executing other pieces of code.
I was just going to say that you can run Lambda on Erlang, you know. That's the whole idea. You should tell to your people when you come back to the office, like, you should re-implement everything.
This doesn't seem to be working. It is working. No, I'm just kidding. So what about Elixir?
Elixir is just a different language on the same runtime, so it's the same story, you know.
The thing that's going to trip you up is that Erlang and Elixir, the Beam environment, is very basically wants to treat processes almost like object-oriented languages want to treat objects. It's like
everything is a process. Yeah,
everything is a process that is sort of naturally a concurrent activity or a sort of a sequence in a concurrent problem, and it should be dirt cheap to create a process. So you should be able to create as many processes as you want.
Right.
So, you know, spawning a process in Erlang takes like a microsecond, and you assume that it's not going to take more. So if you want to fire up to handle one session, fire up 10 different processes that handle a certain, each handles a certain part of the problem, or, and then maybe on the other end of the, you have 10 more, so maybe you have 20 processes for one session, and you want to handle 30,000 sessions or more in one node. That's a lot of processes.
Yeah.
It's not a whole lot of processes for Erlang. You can have millions of processes in an Erlang VM, but the assumption is that it's extremely cheap to send messages and to spawn processes locally.
Yeah.
Then if you go across the network to another node, you have other failure conditions, and you also have more costly messages because it's over TCP, and you assume that you're actually going to a different machine.
Right.
But when you design code in Erlang, you actually, so you have this local domain where things are local, and communication doesn't break between processes because they're in the same VM. That's just an invariant.
Right.
You don't, if that suddenly breaks,
and that's
all bets are
model.
Off.
It
just doesn't, that doesn't happen. When you go across the network, then you deal with network issues, and your code has to deal with that. So at some level, Erlang and Elixir have distributed or location transparency. So you really don't have to worry about where a process resides in the network. But in practice, you often actually want to. You want to have a clear interface between nodes so that you know that if a communication goes across nodes or whether it's locally. So I guess in a serverless environment, it's a little bit difficult to know then how you would view processes and the cost of communicating between processes.
Yeah,
I mean, and especially that will affect your entire design.
If you talk about Lambda, which I presume is at the core of the serverless philosophy, you spin these instances a lot and take them down very frequently. And I mean, Beam takes some significant time to boot up. I mean, we're talking about milliseconds, but still, you know, you don't want to do this too frequently, so it kind of defeats the purpose.
It was kind of a trick. I'm not gonna lie, it was a little bit of a trick question because we actually have and this was not meant to be a pitch for AWS, but I'm throwing it out anyway. So go Chris Buns. And so But what we have this is a custom runtime where you can actually bring your own language. And interestingly enough, there has been in the wild one for Elixir and Erlang created.
Yeah, that's cool to hear.
And the idea, and I see what you're saying, because Erlang, and you can mock and laugh at me and say, wow, you're dumb. But my understanding kind of Erlang is it is important to have that community. It's part of the networking between processes, so it's really designed to go across computer, cross, things like that. Yeah. Whereas a Lambda is a stateless, encapsulated environment, right? Boom, it happens and it goes away. Yeah. But if you want to use that, the Elixir language and things like that, it is absolutely possible. So it's kind of interesting. But I understand what you're saying. Possible is not the same as probable. And so it may not be the best approach, but it is something you can do.
But still, I mean, I was just only half joking when I said that you can, implement Lambda on top of Beam, on top of Erlang or Elixir, because people done it, not in a generic way, but when they need to, they have the smaller cluster of, say, 3 to 5 nodes. When they have to fire up some background activity, they fire it up somewhere, and it's a short living process. A task, does the job and stops, and it runs either here or there. You don't really care on which machine it runs. So
interesting. So it's kind of built for that kind of
distribution is a first class citizen in Erlang, and that's why I believe that it's like an interesting fit for blockchain, right? Which is also distributed in its nature.
So it may. there are two different aspects that are, in this case, I think important to keep separate. And one is you have sort of the core semantics, concurrency semantics of Erlang, which I think are a great fit for that kind of environment, where processes don't really, they have their little life thread essentially, and they have their own memory, they communicate asynchronously, they can monitor and link to each other, so you can actually build sort of self-healing and self-cleaning environment.
It's distributed from day one, right? Even on a single machine.
And, but then you have the practical implementation of Erlang, which, as Sasha pointed out in his demo talk, excellent talk, is very much about the Beam, the Beam VM and how it works. And also here we have the why Ericsson built it in the first place. It was they wanted to experiment with how you should program the next generation of telephone switches.
Okay.
And so then that was their problem domain. It's very nice to have a very concrete problem domain.
Here's the solution. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. Here's the solution. Why are we looking? Here's the problem. Yeah. What's the solution? Yeah, I get it.
So. But what they had then in practice was that you essentially have your control system. It's an orchestration problem. Essentially, you are doing signaling across with other entities on the network, and then you're allocating resources in the hardware switch in the switch. Yeah. Your forwarding engine resources or signal processors, whatever, to link together so that you have in the data plane, you have all the niceties that you need with transcoding and echo cancellation and everything. And then you had these processes in Erlang that they actually had a fairly intimate connection with the hardware. Okay. So you wanted this VM to sit there and actually control certain hardware pieces.
Yeah. Mm.
And then you had the redundancy and also no sandboxing, obviously. Mm. This is telco. You have big locks on the door.
Yeah,
you
had
we thought at least we sold we sold one switch to the Stockholm region, and they there was some debug ports open on the device processors in the switch.
That's no bueno.
And it turned out that some high school students were sitting there, what you typically do, running port scans and say, hey, here are some open telnet ports. Let's see what we can do. So they would just telnet into the device processors on our switches. And there went the assumption that, well, these These operators, yeah. They run safe networks,
yeah,
so we
yeah,
don't
yeah,
have to
exactly.
worry about.
Unless you have high school kids around. You know? So let me ask you, this is a critical question, okay? And I think I just put this together, okay? I've been pondering it. Erlang, is that Ericsson language?
Yes. Or?
Well, not just to pretty face people.
It's an intentional duality.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yes, that's one obvious interpretation.
Okay.
And
which, according to many, is wrong, right?
It's wrong? Are you saying that might be wrong?
Yeah.
Well, so there is this tradition to name languages after...
Yeah.
After mathematicians.
Okay.
Like
and,
Pascal, yeah.
Agne Kalb Erlang.
Okay.
Forgive my poor Danish pronunciation. He was a Danish mathematician, and he was extremely important for teleco.
All right.
Because queuing theory is basically, you know, based on... There's even a unit of measure, Erlang, okay. which is... you measure the frequency of subscribers or customers coming to a service desk or whatever.
Okay.
So it was named after Erlang, but it so happened that you could also...
Ericsson language.
Yeah. Yeah, and that was...
Could be.
It wasn't entirely unintentional.
Okay.
So,
yeah,
but right. It's a secondary...
So I was unintentionally 50% right?
According to some people, and all of them were Danish, you know, it's been named
so
after the...
Outside of Denmark, it's Ericsson language.
Yeah.
And, okay, I understand that.
Yeah.
All right, another critical question. Yeah. In... a sumo wrestling match, who would win? Elixir or Erlang? And why?
I believe they wouldn't compete because they are lightweight.
Wow. That was the best dodge I've ever seen. So, well, guys, I really appreciate you joining us. This was a lot of fun. I'm going to be honest. I've learned more in this session than I thought I would. You know, but no, I really learned. I knew of Erlang. I knew of Elixir. I didn't know how they were related. I didn't know their purposes. I didn't know why anybody would use them. And now I know. And it's actually quite fascinating. But Sasha Ulf, I appreciate you joining us. And I don't know if you want to give a hello, goodbye, hi, mom, anything like that. But thanks a lot. So.
Yeah. Well, thank you for having us. Yeah, it was a blast.
You bet.
It was fun, thanks.
Yeah, thank you. We'll see you later. And we're out.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the GoTo Podcast. Head over to gotopia.tech for lots more content from the brightest minds in software development.